Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Well, the mission leader from the New Horizons Pluto mission, Alan Stern, is our guest. He joins us to talk about his new book, Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto, which he co-wrote with David Grinspoon. Chasing New Horizons is the story of men and women behind this amazing mission, of their decades-long commitment and persistence, of the political fights within and outside of NASA, of the sheer human ingenuity it took to design, build, and fly the mission, and of the plans for the New Horizons' next encounter, 1 billion miles past Pluto. That'll take place in 2019. Alan Stern, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Now, this is a story of tremendous human achievement. And before we talk about a spacecraft that travels 3 billion miles at 32,000 miles per hour and all the challenges as it enters the outer part of our solar system, let's go back to 1989. Getting this project funding, I mean, that's one story in itself. Can you talk about that? I mean, the challenges within NASA are huge to get, as you read this, to be able to get a project put together like this.
Yeah, they really are, and it was a series of adventures and misadventures over about a dozen years to get this funded. You know, NASA gets a lot of proposals to do science missions, and there are about 10 times more good ideas than there are dollars to go around to fund things, so it's very selective. You really have to get to the very, very top of the list. And for those of us that were at the very beginning, the group that we called the Pluto Files, or the Pluto Underground, back in the late 80s and then in the 90s, it was a very long effort that ultimately culminated in 2003 in our being ranked the number one priority. But it took an enormous amount of work and stamina and persistence. And I have to give those people credit. They stuck with it and made a dream come true.
Traditional models of our solar system are very plain, and they show the planets sort of stacked up against each other, revolving around the sun. Of course, that's not really accurate, because Pluto is, for an example, so much further away than the other planets. And I think you did a good job in the book of giving us an idea of just how far it is. If the Earth were the size of a basketball, the sun, 93 million miles away from Earth, would be 5.5 miles away. Pluto would be over 220 miles away. Compared to the universe, the solar system is very small, but the solar system itself, for us, as we explore it, seems to be pretty big.
It's vast. It's vast beyond human comprehension. You know, our spacecraft is the fastest spacecraft ever launched, and it traveled so fast that whereas Apollo missions with Apollo moon landing crews launched at 25,000 miles an hour and took 3 days to reach the moon at that speed, New Horizons reached the orbit of the moon in 9 hours flat, and still it took us 9.5 years to cross the solar system at that blinding speed. It's just incredible how big the solar system is and how far away Pluto is.
Alan, a few minutes ago you talked about being a plutophile, and I'm wondering what makes a plutophile versus, you know, someone who was interested more in NASA's Voyager missions to Uranus and Neptune.
That's a great question, and I have to say, to be honest, almost everybody that I have ever run into that's been involved in this mission, who's a scientist, has multiple scientific interests. My own interests range from research about the Earth's moon and the Earth's upper atmosphere all the way out to the Kuiper Belt where Pluto orbits. And I'm pretty typical of the scientists on the team. But, you know, for those of us who call ourselves plutophiles, it was really about a couple of things. First, all the clues that we were getting from telescopic surveys and things like that were telling us that Pluto was really a scientific wonderland. And so that's a pretty strong incentive when you want to make your career exciting and you want to make discoveries to go to a place like that. But second, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when space exploration was brand new, one of the most prized things a scientist could do was to be on a first mission to an unexplored planet, first to Mars, first to Venus, first to Jupiter, what have you. By the time our generation came along, you know, late 80s, early 90s, all those had been done, from Mercury all the way to Neptune. And Pluto was kind of the last train to Clarksville, the last unexplored planet. Now we know there are a lot more like Pluto farther out in the Kuiper Belt, but still the motivation for us was to be a part of something that there was no other opportunity to do, to be on a first mission to a brand new place and to be explorers. And it was a very strong motivation, and it sustained us through all those difficult times getting this funded and built and flown across the solar system.
Mm. In your conversations with lay people and friends and family and people who were outside but knew about your exploration of the first mission, what were the, you know, what were the myths that people held about Pluto that you knew, boy, you know, when we achieve this exploration, boy, we are going to come back with this kind of information to show the world?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I would categorize as a myth was that people who didn't really know the science, and of course, you know, if you're not in the area, you're not going to know it. But I think a lot of people just thought it would be a boring ice ball. And of course, like I said, it did turn out to be a scientific wonderland with an atmosphere and clouds and hazes and ground fogs and a system of five satellites and glaciers that are in flow and an ocean on the inside. Complicated geology, volcanoes, and soaring mountains, and it just turned out to be spectacular.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Alan Stern, who's the principal investigator, the person responsible for the entire program that went and explored Pluto, a flyby of Pluto. He co-wrote Chasing New Horizons Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto with David Greenspoon. Tell us about that one big moment that you talk about in the book on July 14th in 2015, when you're probably exhausted from all of the things you had to do for the flyby and all the media that was there, and you viewed a package that was sent by New Horizons of fresh pictures, and you had quite a reaction to that. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, thanks for asking about that. And all, you know, all these stories and the things we're talking about are brought out in the book. It's going to appear on May 1st, but you can order it already. You just go to Amazon or other booksellers online, and you can pre-order, so they ship May 1st for you. You know, when we got that first detailed picture that showed how spectacularly beautiful and how strong the personality of Pluto was, with all these varied terrains, this alien world that no one had ever seen before, the size of basically North America. The special moment for me was seeing my team, all these people who had worked on this, one shot, it's either going to work or it doesn't, scientific expedition. People who'd worked on this in many cases for 15 or 20 years, to see the reaction, the emotion on their faces to how beautiful it was, and to the fact that this meant we'd succeeded. After all this working in anonymity for all these years, nights and weekends, 52 weeks a year, very small team, and then when the first detailed images came to the ground and people saw it, there were tears and hugs, and it was so rewarding to just see people achieve this thing that they'd wanted for so much of their careers.
And your proposal started in 1989. The liftoff was in 2006. You got there in 2015. From 1989, let's say 26 years, you are, I think, 10 days away from the flyby. So we're talking about the example that you just talked about was a very big high for you. And now we'll talk about a low. 10 days before the flyby, the spacecraft stopped communicating with you.
Yeah, it was heart-stopping. Nothing like that's ever supposed to ever happen in any space mission. And in the few cases that I had recalled where spacecraft stopped communicating, usually that was game over. For example, a spacecraft called Mars Observer stopped communicating 4 days before arriving at Mars, and it had blown up. And I was sitting in my office near Mission Control. We were 10 days from culminating this 26-year effort. Spacecraft had performed almost flawlessly for the entire journey across the solar system. And it's a Saturday. It's July 4th. Most people are taking the day off. It's a holiday. And I get a phone call from the project manager, and he says to me words that I almost couldn't believe. He said, "Alan, we've lost contact with a spacecraft." And if you've ever seen that movie Apollo 13 and how Mission Control swung into action and round-the-clock work to save that crew, it was something very similar, because we knew the spacecraft was barreling down on, you know, it was going to be at Pluto in 10 days. And we had to regain contact and find out what was wrong and fix what was wrong and get it back on track to start taking all the data, because in almost no time at all, this would be over. And I tell you, our Mission Control and engineering team, what they did was heroic. And people were literally camped out, sleeping on desks and, you know, on the floor 24/7 until we got the problem fixed. And I think they did about 6 months worth of work in a matter of 4 days or so to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. It turned out the spacecraft was fine, and there had been a programming mistake in the way that we had sent some instructions to it. We were able to fix that problem and get all the flight plans back up on the spacecraft, all the computer files. But it was harrowing. And I think the book tells that story in a really interesting way. I hope somebody makes a movie out of it.
It's, as you speak about it, it sounds like a movie, and it's riveting. Well, what a victory then when it finally came back online and you had communication again just in the nick of time. Can you take us through some of the visuals? You know, you talked about oceans and glacial flows and clouds and ground fog and volcanoes. Maybe start by talking about the water on Pluto.
Sure. Well, you know, water is a very common constructional material in the outer solar system. Water ice represents, in the outer solar system, what rock does here on Earth. It's very common in the crusts of planets and satellites out there. And in Pluto's case, we had looked, and using a technique called spectroscopy, never found water ice on Pluto's surface from Earth or the Hubble Space Telescope or anything like that. Pluto's surface is covered in much more exotic materials, condensed methane, that's natural gas, condensed nitrogen and carbon monoxide. But when the spacecraft got there and could see in much more detail, we found these tall soaring mountains as tall as the Rockies. And that told us that Pluto's crust was made of water ice, because the nitrogen and carbon monoxide and other things that we see on the surface, like methane, just aren't strong enough to build mountains out of. If you built a mountain out of one of those things, it would slump under its own weight because they're weak. It's like building a skyscraper out of tissue paper. It wouldn't work. It would collapse. But water ice is very strong, like rock. And so the tall mountains told us that there was probably water ice under this veneer of all these exotic frosts. And then as we got close, the spectrometers on board the spacecraft could see in much more detail, of course, than we could from Earth. And we could see bare patches where water ice was sticking out. For example, maybe places that were windswept and the frosty veneer had been swept off. And that confirmed for us that Pluto's entire crust is made of water ice. And down below, we have evidence that that water actually melts and becomes a liquid and forms a global ocean inside the planet.
Wow. That's fantastic. So... As you're collecting data along with, no doubt, many, many different scientists, what, you know, if you take apart the team that was gathering data, looking at the information that you were bringing off of Pluto, you know, talk about some of those different sciences that were gathering data.
Well, you know, planetary science is a very interdisciplinary field with people, you know, who study atmospheres and satellites and how things are made, the origins of the world, the geology, the geophysics, and all of that is a part of what we found at Pluto. And fortunately, we had experts in all those things, not in all the sub areas. It turned out, for example, our geology team didn't have any glaciologists on it because we didn't expect to find glaciers, but we actually found glaciers ranging over hundreds and hundreds of miles and flowing out of mountains, down valleys, and even subducting at the edges back underground. So we ended up having to hire some glaciologists after the flyby just to add that kind of expertise because it was a complete discovery.
Yeah. We enjoy the warmth of the sun, again, 93 million miles away from the Earth. Again, Pluto is over 3 billion miles, not a lot of light out there. Was that one of the principal, was that one of the driving pieces behind having plutonium, having this nuclear powered?
Yeah, yeah. So at Pluto, the sunlight is 1,000 times dimmer than it is in broad daylight on the Earth. And temperatures are very cold. And the way that most spacecraft are powered, which is with solar power, just doesn't work. The sunlight's too faint and the conditions are too cold. So for all the missions that NASA has flown out to the frontier of the solar system, we've used nuclear power. New Horizons was no different in that. We actually used a spare nuclear power generator fueled with plutonium, the element that was named for the planet Pluto. But our spare was left over from some previous NASA programs to study Jupiter and Saturn. And so we had it fueled up by the Department of Energy and, of course, bolted onto the spacecraft. And that nuclear battery's got enough power not just to take us across the solar system and explore Pluto, but to go on as we are. Our next flyby is going to take place on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day this year, coming up at the end of the year, a billion miles beyond Pluto. And we have enough power to run that spacecraft out into the 2030s, thanks to that nuclear power generator.
Oh, that's great. I wanted to ask you about the future of spaceflight for these unmanned spacecraft. Bill Nye's organization, I think it was about a year and a half ago, put up a space sail that they were going to be testing. And it's a sail that would, I don't believe it picks up photons of light. I think it picks up maybe the solar wind. Is that a viable source of power for future spacecraft?
Well, those sails, called solar sails, reflect the sunlight and use that to create a very gentle but persistent thrust so that it's almost like, think of a car that didn't need a fuel tank and have an infinite fuel tank because it runs on sunlight. And so that technology is not to power the spacecraft, but to help change its trajectory. And the Planetary Society, which Bill Nye runs, is really pioneering that with some flight testers. They're going to do another one this year. And once that technology is perfected, I think for both robotic and human missions, it has just enormous potential to open up new ways to explore the solar system. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of other exciting things going on. I think the 21st century is really where Star Trek begins in terms of space exploration. Fasten your seatbelts, hold on to your hats, because the technologies that are coming online in the commercial sector as well as in the government sector are just like something out of a storybook, science fiction.
Mm-hmm. That's so great. So what's the future for New Horizons? I understand you're bringing it out of hibernation this summer.
That's right. On June 4th, we'll wake the spacecraft up and start preparing for this flyby. First flyby activities begin in August. We are flying to a small, ancient building block of planets like Pluto, something that's only about 20 miles across. Might be a binary, a double object. It might even have moons orbiting that double. We're really looking forward to using this flyby. You know, it's going to be the farthest exploration in the history of humankind. We're really looking forward to this flyby teaching us about how small planets like Pluto on the frontier of the solar system were built. And then we're going to go on farther and farther out into the Kuiper Belt and explore using the telescopes and plasma sensors and so forth on board the spacecraft for years and years to come. New Horizons is perfectly healthy and has the power and the fuel to operate for probably 20 more years.
Dr. Alan Stern, he's the principal investigator for the New Horizons spacecraft that did the spectacular flyby of Pluto. He and David Greenspoon have written a book, Chasing New Horizons. It's available on May 1st. Dr. Stern, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me here. It's been a pleasure.